Catherine Cryer was a judge in Texas for many years before she chucked it all to enter the wacky world of television, where she has been reporting on the law for many years and now has her own show on Court TV. She also has a brand new book, which, by the way, is the book of the week on my website, harrisonline.com. It's called The Case Against Lawyers. Here's what I love about your book, Catherine. It has the longest subtitle I've ever seen.
Thank my publisher for that.
It says, The Case Against Lawyers, and there's a beautiful picture of you, and you're a beautiful woman, and then it says, How the Lawyers, Politicians, and Bureaucrats Have Turned the Law Into an Instrument of Tyranny and What We as Citizens Have to Do About It. Wow, I almost got a whole, I had to take a breath after that.
Well, we got to do the summary, you know?
Yeah.
That's it. That's the story.
This is a terrific read. I don't agree with some of the stuff in here. I really agree with a lot of the other stuff in here. But I want to start right at the very beginning. When you were little Kathy Cryer, did you dream of growing up to be a lawyer?
Yeah. Yeah,
really?
Frightening as it seems. I actually had that ambition from the time I was 4 or 5 years old. And I say it in the book, truly, my mother said it was the fact that I'd argue with the Post and I had to find a profession that would pay me to do it. Yeah, so I had the mouth from the start. And I always thought that was the way to go, because what a noble profession to ensure fairness and justice and all that kind of thing for the American people. And you read the Constitution, what a brilliant document, and you're the guardian. That's fabulous. Well, I'm an idealist, and I sort of bought all of this. And even as early as my time at the DA's office, I started figuring out that reality was a bit different.
Okay, so I was going to ask, when did the reality start breaking apart for you? Was it once you had gone out of law school and you'd been in the business for a couple of years? Because even those first couple of years can start chipping away at your idealism. Was there a certain point where you said, okay, you know what? This isn't about truth. This isn't about justice. This is about a game called the legal system.
And I would say that in those early years, my time in the DA's office brought that to bear, particularly once I got into the felony courts, where you're talking about the rapes and the robberies and the murders, and you look at the bargaining and the pleading and the selective enforcement and, you know, who gets a dismissal and who goes to prison. And you realize that there is a lot of control in the hands of people. Isn't that what King George was? He said, you know, you win, you lose. The rule of law was supposed to supplant that, and
right.
It hasn't.
Okay, so whose fault is that? Is it the lawyers? Is it the judges? Is it the legislatures? Is it evenly spread between them?
Well, I sort of go after everybody, because you just can't blame one. People have said, why did you say the case against lawyers? Because even though I look at bureaucrats and lobbyists and politicians, legislators, those people use lawyers to conduct their business, to write the laws, to enact, to enforce. The lawyers are the judges. So, you know, we are the linchpin in all of this that I'm concerned about. And ultimately, I take a look at us, because I think the American people have a responsibility as well.
When you were practicing law, did you ever do anything that you were ashamed of? That you looked on yourself and said, you know what, I don't want to have to do this, but this is the way you have to do it to win this game?
Well, there were times that I wish I could make a different call, and I didn't. I couldn't do it. And I'll say that was when I was working for the government.
Mm-hmm.
And you just and that's part of the decision to say, nope, this isn't right for me.
Was that because somebody told you to do it a certain way, or because you knew this is the game, here are the rules, I have to play within the rules, or I have to stretch the rules or bend the rules? Which was it?
It was the fact that the rules were wrong. I had to follow the rules, but they were wrong, and I knew they were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, you know, what is morally right to do in this circumstance. And, I have a couple of instances that to this day I think about them.
And
it's a matter of fighting the law, because it's not a question of being immoral. It was just those were the rules, but the rules were wrong. And the good example today is the three strikes or the mandatory minimums. And there are judges now put in the position of, you know, sentencing some teenage girl who went out at her father's instruction and did a drug deal. She gets busted and does 20 years.
Right.
And all of a sudden, there are judges that have actually tried to get inmates out of prison and have worked on this. And I talk about one in the book. And he said, I couldn't do anything but follow the law.
Yeah.
And then he fought and fought and finally got clemency for her.
And one of the things that you talk about in the book, and here's where I'm on the same page you are, is our failed war on drugs. With some of the most draconian laws in place and the mandatory minimums and the complete lack of emphasis on drug treatment and rehab in this country, and instead we think, throw them in jail, that's the answer, and it's not.
Well, and look at the hypocrisy. If you can't quit smoking, you can't ditch nicotine, you get $28 billion.
Yeah.
If you can't quit taking an illegal drug, you go to the pen often for life. Now, that there is something wrong with this picture. Also, I was frustrated that General McCaffrey, who was the drug czar under Clinton, waited until he was leaving office, literally leaving office, to say something that I suggest he knew all along, and that was, this is not a criminal justice problem. It is a public health problem.
Right.
That's the only way. We cannot incarcerate ourselves out of this. Well, thanks, General. You know, it's safe for you to say that now. And that's the problem, is that people, particularly the politicians who could make changes, are afraid. And unless the American people stand up and start screaming, we want you to make these changes, and we will vote for you if you do, and we don't think you're soft on crime because you try and figure out a way not to spend hundreds of billions of dollars, which is essentially throwing it down the toilet. We've got to speak up and let them know.
Right. Well, you know what happens, though, is one politician speaks up about this, and in the next election, their opponent puts one of those negative ads on that says, Jim, whatever his name is not only soft on crime, he wants to let all the cocaine dealers out to go to your daughter's schoolyard and get her addicted to drugs. That's what they do.
You're absolutely right, but can't we actually look at the case and determine whether or not that's true?
I wish we could.
What's he asking for? Is he asking to simply decriminalize dope? Is he asking to cut back on mandatory minimums? Is he asking to provide treatment? And if he is, let's get a grip.
You're in favor of decriminalizing marijuana?
Oh, sure.
Make it a misdemeanor, a fine?
Oh, sure. I mean, can you imagine that we're spending, on an average, $30,000 a year per person to put a bunch of nonviolent dope smokers in prison?
Yeah.
That's insane.
One guy bought a Grateful Dead thing, and that led to his whole lifelong ruination of everything.
Yeah.
I don't buy that.
That's nuts.
Now, when you were a judge sitting on that court there in Texas, on that bench, did you have frivolous lawsuits come before you that you were able to throw out and say, you know what, I'm in charge here, this is ridiculous, get out of my courtroom?
Absolutely. Oh, sure. I was able to dismiss cases. I was able to encourage what we call motions for summary judgment, where the defendant simply has to come in and say, look, the guy can't prove the lawsuit. Here's the motion. And that's a way to really cut to the quick and go, you're right. The evidence is not there to even contest, to put it in front of a trier of fact. Out the window it goes.
Why is that not done more often, Catherine?
Oh, I think it's a couple of different reasons. One, particularly in the states that elect judges, the obvious, they're really concerned about remaining elected, and they don't want lawyers and they don't want contributors to be upset. Two, I think it's easier many times to shuffle it off to a court of appeals because anytime you take a stand, you could be questioned on that. So move it on up. Let somebody else worry with it. And three, gee, if you're not trying this case, you're trying another one. So this one's easy. Put your feet up. Try it. You'll worry about the complex ones down the road.
So laziness is the key here.
Could be that aspect in part of them.
You know, I just want to go off on this electing judges thing for a second as well. You know, I try to be a good citizen. I try to vote in the primaries. I try to vote in the general elections, even though I hate politicians. Every once in a while, you got to go in there and hold your nose. And,
sure.
And it, for me, it's always been voting for the lesser of two evils.
Yep.
In every election I've ever voted for, I've never voted for somebody.
Uh-huh.
I've always voted against the other guy. But anyway, when it comes to electing judges, particularly here in this area, who knows what a judge is or what they stand for? And I go in there and I see nine names and it says pick five. And, I'll go the odd number judges this year. I mean, nobody knows about that. So why do these guys even worry about getting reelected? I don't think any American truly does have the resources to pay attention to that or the desire to.
Well, and the sad part about it, if you get on the ballot in a party system or even a nonpartisan system, you're going to get a spot sooner or later if you run long enough. It's almost that inevitable, and we know nothing about these guys. Here we want to worry so much about congressmen and senators, and it's likely that the only one of the three that you're really going to need and you're going to be standing in front of someday is that judge.
Yeah, that's right. All right, here's one area where you and I disagree. By the way, talking with Catherine Cryer, the book is The Case Against Lawyers. It's the book of the week on harrisonline.com and available in bookstores all over America and bound to be a bestseller, I'm sure, because it is a great read. But here's where we differ. You want to go to a loser pays system in our civil courts, right?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, with modifications. Loser pays in basically most of the cases. Because the people who could be hurt by that are the impoverished, who might not be able to bring a legitimate claim because they cannot pick up the court costs if they can't prove it. The judge has to review those costs and fees. And there are cases where trusting the judge's experience and wisdom, which is why we put them up there in the first place, they can say, oh, in this case, I can look at the facts. It was a legitimate presentation. The jury disagreed, or there was an element that couldn't be proven, and we do not assess. Okay? We take care of those guys by using reason and pragmatic response. In most of the cases, though, what this will do is stop the flood of frivolous lawsuits. When you realize that if you go in there and take everybody's time, file these cases, make them respond, make the court grind to a halt while they're addressing your problem, you're going to pay if it's frivolous.
Here's the problem I have with that argument.
Okay.
You want to protect the people at the absolute bottom so that they can still sue and have their legal protections, which is great. But what about the people in the middle class American who is wronged by a corporation? And I don't mean, you know, a hot cup of coffee kind of McDonald's kind of lawsuit, but somebody who truly is wronged by tires that were put on an SUV wrong, or a staircase in a mall that should have been maintained, but it wasn't, and somebody slips and falls and breaks a hip. The middle class American who, you know, you look at them and you go, well, you're not poor. Get yourself a lawyer. But then they go up against some multinational corporation with 300 lawyers all on staff, not even on retainer, and then they get buried in paperwork, and they can't fight their way out of it, and they have to pay for those 300 lawyers. How can they possibly survive?
But you have given the best example for the philosophical argument I make in the book, and that is the more rules and regulations you have, the less you can rely on human judgment. Judges now have determinative sentencing. X happens, they go down the chart, and they sentence somebody to Y. Same thing with those mandatory minimums. They can't look at the facts, look at the circumstances, and make the punishment fit the crime. If you write a law where loser pays unless in the discretion of the judge, given the factual circumstances, da-da-da-da-da, and then you actually let the judge look at the case and say, this was a serious, legitimate claim. You know, the cost effect is X. The reason for protracted litigation is Y. And you balance the interests. But what that means is letting the judge do his or her job and not screaming every time they do X over here and they might do Y over here because they perceive them differently. I don't want to hear everybody going, oh, discrimination, this is a violation. Everybody's got to be treated exactly the same, because every instance isn't the same. But if, in fact, we allow, through more broad descriptions, the reasonable man standard that we have abandoned, then you're letting us use our judgment to not abuse a rule like that, but make it serve its original purpose.
Doesn't this go back to what we were just talking about the judges having the discretion and actually using it to throw the cases out of court like you did?
Yeah, what we've gotten to the point is everybody's terrified to use their judgment, whether in hiring and firing personnel, whether in disciplining a student, whether in making a ruling from the bench, because the more rules and laws you have, the less you can use your mind, the senses that are supposed to distinguish us from the animals, because you're afraid of getting in trouble. Oh. You got to pull out the rule book, find some answer which may not apply, like absolute poverty. No, you got to use some reason in determining how to apply that. And that's one of the things the book calls for.
Very well said, and that's exactly how we end up with zero tolerance policies in schools and nonsense like that. Now, what do we do about huge verdicts, this $28 billion smoking verdict in California you mentioned? It's never going to be that much, but the person in Florida who got $3 billion, they ended up getting, you know, $100 million settlement when the thing was all done against Philip Morris. Is there an area where we can get common sense back into that kind of legal?
There are a couple of obvious things, I think. Along with the loser pays, you have the elimination of contingency fees, unless it's for the impoverished who were supposed to be able to get lawyers by giving them a percentage of a recovery. Other than that, we ought to get rid of contingency fees. What does that make the lawyer? A partner in the litigation. So if I'm a partner, I want to maximize my income. I'm going to ask for sometimes the most outlandish numbers, and maybe 1 out of 100 times I'm going to get them. And that's my 30 or 40%, talking about that $23 billion. So you eliminate contingency fees, so I don't have an interest in your problem other than my hourly fee, which is what I'm supposed to be working for. Then you actually come in and do the heinous thing called tort reform. And I know that the plaintiff's bar, and, you know, I'm sorry, I like plenty of them, are putting in so much money into Capitol Hill that it's pretty hard to raise that subject. But, in fact, we need decent tort reform, not to let the corporations or the bad guys walk all over us, but, in fact, to restore some semblance of sanity to this. You cap punitive damages. You get rid of some of these bizarre psychological damages that are absolutely unprovable. And you bring some rationality back to what people recover to truly compensate them for their damages.
Yeah, the problem is you're never going to get the money out of there, not just from the plaintiff's lawyer, lawyers, but also from the defense lawyers. They're going to all get their lobbyists to go to the legislature in their state and on Capitol Hill and argue back and forth. And I'm with you. I think
you're right. Unless, I mean, be real clear, this goes on all the time. The buying and selling of law. I worry about this even more than the taking of money on Capitol Hill. Our legislature sells laws.
Yes.
Subsidies, tax write-offs, exemptions from environmental laws, you name it. That goes on all the time.
And, you know, extortion is supposed to be a crime.
Well, yeah, but it's hard to prove. It's like Lanny Davis said in his book, To Tell the Truth. They were arguing about whether or not they could prove bribery in the Chinagate stuff, and they're going, you can never prove that stuff. You can write a law and have an excuse for it any day of the week.
Yep.
And that's really the truth. But if the American people have the same number of votes as those guys, in other words, Jack Welch and I get one vote each. And if I get a million people supporting my position, he doesn't have a prayer.
Yep, I wish that we could get to that. Speaking of Jack Welch, I don't mean to...
I pulled his name out of the air.
I don't mean to lop him into this category. Let's put him aside, but hearing his name makes me ask this question. Can the law do anything about these lying, cheating CEOs, the Dennis Kozlowskis of the world?
Absolutely. We've got plenty of laws on the books to take care of it, but I'll tell you what, we need to not buy what we're being sold right now, and that is big bad corporations are doing all of this stuff, and the members of Congress are going, I'm shocked to know there's gambling in this joint, because in fact, they allowed this to happen. They knowingly, I would suggest, turned their backs on Enron when Enron says, we want to be exempted from certain commodities regulations. And the government, the people who had been taking those contributions, said, sure, no problem. Write a little provision exempting them from an act that governs other companies.
Right.
The reason they were able to do so much of this offshore BS was because they weren't being reviewed, because they were exempted, thanks to those contributions on Capitol Hill.
Yep.
So those guys, turning their backs on the accountants, when Arthur Levitt of the SEC said, if you let accountants consult and audit, we're in big trouble. Do you know what happened from Congress? They got teed off. They said, you don't shut your mouth. We're cutting your budget.
Right.
And
yeah.
He talks about it in his new book. Clearly, we're going to cut your budget. So let these guys do what they want. Now, look what's happened.
This is the same Congress that makes labor laws that affect everybody else, but they don't affect people who work in Congress.
Our own president is now saying, I can't have these Homeland Security personnel unless you get off my back with the employment laws. And I'd like to say, Mr. President, why don't you deal with the rest of the business world in the same fashion you want to be dealt with?
Speaking of the administration, I got to ask you, I only got a few minutes left here, but let's talk about John Ashcroft and the Justice Department and the war on terrorism and the secret trials and the listening in on lawyer-client meetings and all that sort of stuff. As a lawyer and a former judge, what's your reaction to all this stuff you hear?
Well, I'm one of these that believes in privacy and civil rights. And not, when I say civil, we're not talking about the ethnic, racial stuff. I'm talking about our rights as all Americans to not have the government invade. What we're doing, and we do this every time there's a threat in this country, the world wars, various times, where the government reaches out and says, if you'll just give me a little more power, I'll make you secure. Well, there's no word on a page that has ever made a human being secure. It's the actions of other individuals.
Yep.
But what they're doing is saying, if you'll just give us a little more right to invade, a little more right to do what we think is best without your review, it'll be okay. Well, they're going to get the power. We're not going to get the results. And there are going to be abuses that follow. Now, I want to catch the bad guys, but I actually think we've got most of the laws we need to do exactly that. If the FBI and CIA and the other guys had been doing their jobs,
yep,
as is now available to do,
yep,
then we would have had some good results. We don't need more laws.
That's exactly right. I can't stand it when we have a problem and people say, well, you know what, we're not doing enough about this. We need more laws. No. We need to do more with the laws that we have and do the jobs that we were assigned to do.
Yeah.
That's why on my website I've got that quote from Benjamin Franklin in 1759, those who would give up essential liberty to obtain a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety.
Right on, Ben.
All right. Catherine Cryer, the book, The Case Against Lawyers, with the huge long subtitle, but look for her beautiful face on the cover. And it's the book of the week on harrisonline.com and sure to be a bestseller. Thank you for your time. Let's do this again.
Thanks, Paul. Enjoyed it.
Catherine Cryer here on the Paul Harris Show. This is the Big 550 KTRS.
Did you know that the Salvation Army has been helping people?